Hello, everyone. I'm Luis, and this is The Debrief, a podcast from Incident.io. What if I told you that everything you thought you knew about incident response was wrong? Well, at least some of it. That some of the things you've been doing for years might not actually be having the impact you thought they did. Or even worse, that some of the assumptions you've been making have actually been having a negative impact on you, your team, and your organization. This week, we're talking about myths around incident response. And who better to dispel some of these myths than the director of engineering at HashiCorp, Colette Alexander. We chat about myths around learning and process, why is the wrong question to be asking after incidents, and why documenting risk doesn't necessarily help you manage them. We cover quite a bit in this episode, but before we jump in, I just wanted to take a second to highlight the fact that this is our 20th episode of the podcast. This is a really big milestone for us here at Incident.io, so I just wanted to take a second to highlight and celebrate this. And if you've been listening, a very, very, very big thank you to you. But anyway, let's move on to the good stuff. Here's my conversation with Colette. Colette, thank you so much for joining us on The Debrief today. I'm really, really excited about the conversation that we're about to have about myths around managing incidents. But first, as we always do, love to start with a quick intro so everybody can get acquainted with who you are. So would you mind telling us a bit about yourself?
Sure. I'm Colette. I'm a director of engineering at HashiCorp. My organization is the SRE and observability teams. Before I was at HashiCorp, I was at a small startup called Cognite. Before that, I was at Spotify for 4.5 years working in engineering management. And before that, I was working at Hewlett-Packard and IBM with the OpenStack teams who build their infrastructure systems for OpenStack. And then before that, I was a cellist in rock bands for most of my 20s. So I have what most people refer to as a non-traditional background in tech. So I've worked with a lot of engineering teams that have incidents. I've managed them. I've managed managers of them. And I've been put in charge of improving reliability in an organization, which of course means getting really deep into incidents and how they happen. So that's my experience.
I'm not going to let you blow by the fact that you are a cellist. We're going to touch on that for sure. But before that, your background is interesting because you've been at companies of all different sort of types and sizes. So like Hewlett-Packard, so like Spotify, HashiCorp, Cognite. What is that like just holding these different roles at companies that are so different and are at different sort of stages? Like I look at a Hewlett-Packard that's been around for decades. And then I look at a Spotify, which, I mean, at this point in 2024, it's like an established player in the game, but still relatively new compared to something like a Hewlett-Packard.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's funny. At HP and IBM, I was working with their OpenStack teams who were kind of like operating as these little islands in the middle of the huge. So in some ways, they were also like their own mini startups. But I do think, you know, what strikes me actually is how similar these problems are everywhere, like how so many places have the same problems, regardless of their size. I do think like the Hewlett-Packard was so big and IBM was so big that you couldn't say that there was just one culture. And I do think that that's a profound difference from like, say, Spotify, where even as big as Spotify got while I was there, I think when I left, there were maybe like 6,000 people working there. It grew a little bit bigger after that. But even when I left, I felt like there was definitely more consistency culturally across the organization than if you go to different places in HP, it's just like could be totally different experience, right?
Well, it's time to talk about you being a cellist.
Okay.
Please explain.
So I started playing the cello when I was 4, and I started like tinkering with computers when I was probably 7 or 8. So cello wins, but only by like 3 or 4 years. But I ended up kind of going through kind of normal college and then decided at the last minute to go to graduate school for cello performance instead of like do something else. And I sort of had no idea what I was going to do. I was like really, I was feeling totally insane by the end. Like, why did I just do this graduate degree? And then like 4 days after I graduated, I had an audition with a singer-songwriter named Rachel Yamagata. And I was the only cellist, I think, who showed up who would just like improvise with her. So I got the gig. And then for like a decade, I just ended up working with various artists. At the time, you know, this was, I'm going to date myself now, but this was like in the mid-aughts, right? So it was sort of like a good emerging time for like sad singer-songwriters who needed a cellist. So I had some pretty good gigs in that genre. And then I also worked with some folks in indie pop. I worked with a guy named Jens Lakeman. And then I ended up working with Josh Groban for a little bit. I was his solo cellist. And that was pretty wild. So, and then I kind of like floated back after many, many years of being on the road a lot. I realized, you know, I wanted to have a family and some stability and stuff. And so I kind of sort of slowly sauntered back into the like tech universe in my 30s. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, if any of you listening are a cellist turned engineer, there's someone just like you. You are not alone.
And I still play. I record for people now. I don't tour because I have a family. It'd be hard to do. But I record in my recording studio for folks. And I love to play still. It's awesome. So.
Yeah. Well, I'd love to maybe in another episode we can have tour stories and all of that. But like I said at the beginning, we're here to talk about myths around managing incidents. So yes. I think to start, I'd love if you could just like at a very high level talk through some of these myths that we're going to discuss throughout this conversation, and then we can double tap on them one at a time.
Yeah. So I think I picked four.
Okay.
So I think the first good one is that learning is not the same thing as fixing. And there's a little sub bullet point around action items there that we'll get into. And then another one is, it's not really like useful to ask why as much as it is useful to ask how. And we'll talk about the differences there, I think, that are really important. Another myth about incidents is that the sequence of incidents is very pat, that like, you know, there's detect, triage, you know, fix, and then resolve and learn, right? That these are these amazing pat sections. They're not. And then I think another myth that I encounter that's sort of incident adjacent that we can get into, that I happen to write a thesis on for my graduate degree in human factors and system safety, is that documenting risks somehow helps us manage them. And I think that that's sort of often what happens after incidents or before them. And we think we are managing them and we don't really.
Gotcha. So let's start out with learning is not the same as fixing. And learning, particularly within the context of incident management, is a very hot topic. I think probably even more so now, like there are people on all sides of the debate. So what do you mean by learning is not the same as fixing?
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess full disclosure, I'm a part of the learning from incidents community and software. And like my mentor and friend, John Allspa, is probably totally responsible for anything that comes out of my mouth during about incidents this time. So it's your fault, John. So there are sort of opinions about this floating around that people may have heard or not. But I think, you know, to sort of distill it down, we have this sense, or especially when I think you're a leader in an organization, we tend to have this sense of like, oh, an incident happened and I have to make sure that we're getting the most out of this. And so it's really important that my team go do a postmortem, post-incident review, and come out with some action items. Now that's the real gold. And then if they do the action items, then that incident won't happen again, right? That's what I think is like a sort of very stereotypical view on this. And I'm here to tell you that's a lie. And which isn't to say that your team shouldn't do a post-incident review and that your team shouldn't have action items. I think it's totally fine for them to have action items. But I think it's important to understand that often teams are going into these post-incident reviews and they're going in with the mindset of coming up with those action items rather than necessarily learning about the systems that were at play and what confusing things happened during the incident and what was really weird or like strange about the system that they didn't understand, that they now understand, or even kind of asking somebody else in the incident sort of review if, like what they think about that. So the action items aren't really geared towards learning. They're geared towards sort of work, like doing something. I also think it's true, by the way, that most teams who have incidents, as soon as those incidents are kind of contained, I would call that, they often just go and do stuff that needs to be done anyways. They will often just go file JIRA tickets. Like I see this happen even before a post-incident review, right? That they kind of know that there's some things to explore, some things to dig into, and I'll see them just filing those tickets or making that work known to others. And so I think the larger question that the learning from incidents community sort of asks is there more learning that we can do here that isn't sort of geared towards fixing? And I think that, like, in my experience, doing in-depth incident analyses where you interview people who are involved in the incident and like pull out their expertise about the systems and then write about that in a way that is digestible by all sort of people in the organization. When you do that and then you have your post-incident review, maybe a week later, where you can then come up with action items, you might see a shift in the types of action items and the sorts of things that come up and what to do.
One question that I do have is, like you said, action items are typically things that people are going to do off the back of an incident anyway. So in your mind, is it even worth documenting them post-incident, or should you just assume that people know what they have to do? If something is broken, they don't need to list it out, because they're going to do it anyway.
Well, and I think it depends on the action item, right, too? And this is another sort of case for like learning before you do your action items, because the action item is something that like a team can handle. And this is the other thing is that often action items are like, if the team is really focused, they're just things that they're coming up with that are in the scope of what the team can manage. Now, if we recently did an in-depth incident analysis that called out the fact that like, some of the engineers might not feel comfortable being on call, but what is the team going to feel empowered to do about that, right? And so I think that that's a really important documentation for managers, for leaders at the company to know, so we can start thinking about how we can better support those kinds of systems. Does that make sense? I think it's important to document, but I think what we document and who we're talking to when we document those sort of observations, or another really good one that I saw a lot at Spotify was like, you know, it makes sense, right, when you think about it, but it can kind of be scary for some other engineers to know, is that the 99% of the time when a consumer like incident happened at Spotify, engineers would validate that we were back up by like pulling out their phones and turning on Spotify, right? So they weren't like looking at any particular, there was no like grand system, right? And we marked that enough as like an observation after doing in-depth incident analyses that like there were people who were like, oh, like maybe we should think about that struck like in a big way as like an infrastructure product, right? Or maybe we're okay with that, right? Maybe that's a thing that happens.
What would your guidance be to an organization who is sort of disregarding everything that you're saying right now? Like, and follow up or so action items are like key to how they, you know, respond post-incident. Like, what is your guidance to them? Like, what do they risk by having that be their like end goal, is documenting these action items?
The real risk of doing this is that you will find yourself, and I've talked to leaders that have had this happen, right? Where they say, there was one incident that happened. And then later there was many months later, maybe even there was another incident that happened and they were very similar. And I noticed that the action items from the previous incident had not been completed. And so after this incident, I went and I made sure we documented everything, all the action items, they all got done. And then, you know, many months later, I'm talking to them and I'm like, yeah. And then what happened? And they're like, and then the incident happened again. Right. Like then the similar, like, so it turns out, right, if your teams are having similar incidents, and that can also be a myth, but whatever, that if your teams are having similar incidents over and over again, and you're getting frustrated and they're making action items, perhaps step back for a second and ask whether the teams or you or anybody in the organization really understands what's going on with the incident, and ask if perhaps spending more time digging into people's perceptions of the systems involved in the incident, not just the technical systems, but also the social systems involved in the incident, whether learning more about those can help you actually address the problems that are happening, right? If you find yourself stuck in that loop, because that's what I think the risk is, right? Is that you get in a loop where everyone's like, but I checked my action items off. This shouldn't have happened again. It's like, well, you know, maybe it's because you're not really learning enough about what's really happening, right?
So you just mentioned the myth of similar incidents. I know that that wasn't part of your original list that you laid up at the beginning, but I'd love if you could talk about that.
So I think that, like, there is this idea, right? I want to sort of back up and think about our conceptions of what causes an incident, right? And what an incident represents for us. In an organization. So often what I find is that people think of an incident as this moment where, oh gosh, this perfect system blew up and now it's, you know, we're sort of dealing with this imperfection. And then, you know, the action items again at the end will help us get back to this perfect system. And I think that that can play, this idea of root cause also plays into it, that there should be a root cause that we uncover. And when we solve for that root cause, we should not have repeats of the incidents. And I think that, like, all of those beliefs are fundamentally misunderstanding day in and day out the systems that we deal with, that engineers deal with, which are always broken a little bit. All systems, especially as complex as software systems, are just constantly operating in a state of degradation, right? There's always something that's a little broken. I think my friend, the late Dr. Richard Cook, once said at a conference talk, he said, you all are sitting here, you're not surprised the system is down. You're surprised it was up in the first place. And I think that it's like a fundamental reality that people who work in software engineering kind of understand viscerally, but others may not totally get. So the system is never perfect, right? So that's the first thing to understand. And because the system is constantly shifting, constantly in this degraded and then sort of improved and then degraded again state, when we look at the surface event, the incident, and we see some kind of repeated pattern, it's probably not actually underneath exactly. The system isn't exactly the same spot that it was the last time that this happened, right? It's something is slightly different. Something has shifted. The things underlying and the people involved are probably quite different, right? It might appear like the symptoms might be very similar, but it's likely not a repeat incident in this kind of cookie cutter way.
At the beginning, you mentioned John Allspaugh and you just mentioned root cause. I remember reading something in one of his blog posts that root cause analysis is not something you should be doing anyway. Where do you stand on that?
Oh, I mean, I think root cause is a myth, right? Like, again,
oh no, this not idea, enough.
This idea that we can find one specific thing that caused the whole problem, again, harkens back to this idea that it was a perfect system. And then one thing came in and messed it all up. And we all know that that's just not the state of our systems, right? That's not how software engineering works.
If there's anything I'm learning in the 10 minutes we've been chatting so far, is that there are a lot of myths.
So many myths.
Yeah. I would love to get to all of them. Maybe we can break this out into a series of the myths of incident response. But I want to segue back to the sort of original set of myths that we were going to chat about. So let's talk about asking why instead of how, and why that can be so dangerous and misleading at the end of the day.
John has a blog post called The Infinite Hows, where he kind of goes into why, in particularly attacks five whys, which is fine. I think I can sort of, I want to go a little bit away from maybe fully attacking Five Whys and go into what it means to ask how and how that is different than asking why. So when we ask why, and like, we can kind of come up with, we often focus on because the engineer did this, because so-and-so thought this was true, or because this was, you know, we kind of come up with these very surface things. When we ask how someone came to believe something or how someone understood a particular event and then it surprised them, that's when we start to get into understanding people's views of the systems that they're working in. And that's when we start getting into learning. There is a framework called, it's called a local rationality sort of study that happens in safety, in the safety world. So if you like, my thesis advisor is the head of safety for the Dutch railway system, and they do what they call local rationality investigations. So they go interview people involved in incidents or near misses even, and they sort of find out, you know, how did you understand what was happening, what was going on around you? And sort of diving into that single person perspective and mining the expertise of the person involved can really help reveal the system at play and also how the system surprised that person or didn't, right? I think one of the ways that if you're just doing what I would call a traditional post-incident review, where you feel like you don't have a ton of time and you can't kind of do in-depth interviews with folks who are involved, that's okay. One of the ways that I like to do this in when I'm facilitating incident reviews is just ask, you know, what was surprising to anybody here about this incident? Yeah. And then also like, what wasn't surprising? So what went about how you expected it to, right? What are the things that you expect the system to do that it did? And that can reveal a lot, I think, about how the systems are behaving and maybe come up with like interesting themes or things to address that wouldn't be expected if you were just kind of drilling down why to this tiny little thing.
I want to ask, blamelessness and post-incident, postmortems, whatever you want to call them, sort of seem to go hand in hand. Like they're typically part of the same conversation. Would you say that the five whys aren't very compatible with blamelessness? Because at the end, it does feel like when you're asking why, you end up singling out a person, whereas with how, I think you're avoiding that entirely. But you let me know if that's the wrong read.
I mean, I think that can often happen, right?
Yeah.
The other thing that happens when we ask why, even if it's of a system, why did the system behave this way? Well, it behaved this way because it does this, this, and this. Well, why does it do that, that, and that? Because, well, someone chose. Like, it always ends up coming back to a person, right?
Exactly, yeah.
And I think blamelessness, as John likes to say, is table stakes. Like, that has to be a given if you're going to make space to find out what people were thinking or understanding when they went through what they went through, right? So, and I don't know that why gets you there.
So now let's talk about the myth that incidents follow a set sequence all the time.
So our tools are built on this. Our mean time to whatevers are built on this, right? And I think it's interesting because if you ask any engineers dealt with incidents, like, have you ever had an incident where it was resolved before you even knew it happened, right? They would say, yeah. And then my favorite is, you know, oh, this incident ended and we all went on a merry way. And then like 30 minutes later, it came back because it turns out that, you know, what we thought was true about it wasn't, about the system wasn't really true. So I think that this is an interesting one that has connotations because if you have an incident tool that automatically updates things based on the phase of the incident you're in, you may be handicapping your team in a way when they need to go back to a previous phase or they need to, right? And so thinking about that and thinking about what that really means, I think is important. I think the other, like I mentioned, thing that's important about understanding that sequences don't really work that way is your mean time to recoveries, all of these sort of statistics about incidents become you know, you have kind of like ridiculous outlying values, like, oh, this is a negative me time to recovery, I guess. If we detected it after it happened and was resolved.
Two follow-ups there. So how does that fit into having a process in place? Because like when you have a process in place, you are making a lot of assumptions. You're assuming that this is going to look like this, this is going to look like this, and based on how this looks, this is how we respond. How do you do that if things are always going to be so different? How do you make assumptions? Because at the end of the day, these assumptions help you move faster. You know, at least I would think you assume that if this incident looks like this, that your response is going to be like this, which lessens the amount of time that you're sitting around wondering how you're going to respond. But how do you have these processes in place if everything technically just looks so different every time?
Yeah, I mean, I think you can still have processes in place. I think I would just challenge the assumptions that come along with those, right? And try to make them as flexible as possible. I think like you could also, like, I've worked in places where it's like somebody's like, that looks a little weird. I'm going to keep an eye on that while I eat my lunch. And then they might like slack somebody like, this looks a little weird. Do you think this looks weird? And then they'll be like, I don't know. I might have to like hit this thing and like figure it out. And oh, I'm just going to do this. It'll take care of it. And then boom, it's done. They probably didn't even declare an incident. And so I think like, what was that an incident? This gets into the ultimate question. And I think it's about creating loose enough structures that they can be helpful to the people if they choose to engage in them, but are not hindering their ability to maneuver, their capacity to maneuver, I think is the right way to put it. If we're going to base it on the science, there's a concept that a guy named Dave Woods has talked about, which is called graceful extensibility. And inside of that is a concept of the capacity to maneuver is really important for people in situations. The ability for the humans to adapt within the system is the most important thing for resilience, essentially.
Have you ever been part of an organization where there was a process in place that was like so rigid that you felt like there was no adaptability there, that you had to, despite you knowing that this probably wasn't the best way to operate, that you had to stick to it, sort of to the detriment of you, ultimately you and your team?
I think where I've been in organizations before that required, this is kind of interesting, that required postmortems to be done on every single incident.
Yeah.
And what was interesting is that, and here's one for your statistic loving folks, but like when we stopped that, when we said like, look, we think this is actually hindering people from calling incidents because they just don't want to have the paperwork, we started seeing like a huge uptick in the number of incidents called. Now, was there actually an uptick in incidents? No. It was that people were less afraid to call them and sort of summon folks if they didn't think that they would have a ton of paperwork to do after like a SEV4, right?
Yeah.
So in that sense, I've seen it hinder people. I've also seen just like automation kind of go a little bit awry there, right? Where it's like, oh, this is a SEV2, that automatically means this, this, and this are going to get kicked off. And somebody's like, well, but I'm not sure it's a SEV2, and I need some more people here to talk about it. Like, it becomes like all of the automation sort of can sometimes get in the way of people actually having the conversations they need to have. And that's something that I have seen before. So I would just like, I think it's an important thing to keep in mind. You want to be supportive, but if you even just any group that has an incident process, like the most interesting thing to do would be to go observe people using it and then observe people not using it, right? Like, what are they avoiding? Like, when are they avoiding it? And is that okay? Like, does your organization want to have that be the case? Or is it possible to help them use more things and have more of a record of this stuff if you take out some of the sort of extra paperwork, I would call it, usually is what prevents people from engaging in their incident process.
You referenced metrics a few times over the last few minutes, and I'm wondering, Are there any myths associated with those? Like, sort of separate question there is, like, where do you stand on metrics and how usable they are, particularly things like mean time type metrics?
Yeah. I mean, I come at this from, I was put in charge in my org at Spotify of like solving for reliability for like a pretty large organization. And we did all of the things. Like I partnered with a staff engineer and we got all of the statistics. We got so many numbers. I was looking at them. We were looking at each other, like looking at the numbers, like, and I'm like, this doesn't tell me anything that's like useful for like where we need to go. Right. And I think, and here's the thing. I think mean time to recovery, all the DORA metrics, they weren't invented for everybody to follow and try to do like a tiny percentage improvement on every year. They were invented for organizations who were doing DevOps transformations and trying to go from, you know, quarterly releases to like 50 commits a day, right? That's a huge gap and change. And I think that probably those metrics are still useful for organizations who are trying to undergo that level of transformation. It's just they're not really meant for organizations who've already done that work. At Spotify, we already were at 50 plus commits a day to this particular code base that we had. And like, it wasn't telling us anything. What I did start to learn was by doing in-depth incident analysis. And once we started getting in-depth incident analysis, I felt as a leader that I had signal on what are the kinds of tools or systems that my teams are using, what's helping them, what's not helping them. What are the areas where we really see people struggling to understand how to do something or how to engage in our incident process? Like, there are so many themes in incidents that can get uncovered when you do this in-depth analysis that John calls them shallow metrics. I think they really are quite shallow when it comes to explaining to you what's really going on when you have incidents.
Yeah, I wanted to be sure to ask about that because a few weeks ago at this point, we conducted a survey with a bunch of customers and asked like, okay, what are the incident metrics that you track? Just to get a sense of like what's important to people. But basically, like, long story short, most people mentioned like MTTR as a primary metric that they track. But then when we asked, okay, so like, what do you do to action the insights that you get from these? Like, most people said, well, not anything really. And then it sort of, and we said this in the report, it begs the question. So like, why are you tracking them? And should you be tracking something else that might give you some actionable insights? Because if you're tracking just for the sake of tracking, like, you know, you're not really moving the needle, but if you're tracking something that's like giving you genuine insight and things that you can action, that's a different story. But yeah, I just wanted to make sure to ask you about that because it's something that's been top of mind for me.
And if you're a leader, I mean, I'm a director of engineering right now, right? If you're a leader in an organization, I empathize because you need some kind of signal to know if your org is doing okay. And you can't sort of get that signal as easily once you're very removed from the action, so to speak. So I empathize. Like one stat that we did love that actually you can get, I think, and it's an IO, is how many hours, how many engineering hours are being spent on incidents. And I think that's an interesting number in the sense that like you can talk about disrupted work, but you know, like you can also talk about disrupted work by talking to any of the engineering managers or, you know, product managers or anybody else who's like, my work isn't getting done because my engineers are spending all their time in incidents. So, you know, you can get that signal a lot of other ways as well, I think. But having that number of hours was, I do remember presenting it to one vice president when we were doing our improvement effort. And they were like, oh, that's a lot. And I was like, yeah, it's a lot.
Yeah. On that note, are there any metrics that you found are useful or at least more useful than other sort of mean time to type metrics?
I think the hard thing with mean time is you're abstracting away, especially if you're tracking it across multiple teams and then averaging that or meaning that, you're sort of abstracting away the context that it's happening in. But I do think at the local level, I do think engineering managers could probably like find mean time to recovery broadly useful, just like how many hours a week are my engineers spending on incidents or in disruptive kind of work cycles? And then my personal favorite is actually how long does it take us from the time an incident is detected until like we've sort of mustered and are responding, right? And I think that that speaks to an operational muscle that is like, if it takes you 5 minutes from time to detect of detection to actual response time, then I think like you've probably got a pretty well-oiled machine. I mean, maybe not well-oiled enough if you want 5.9s or something like that, if that's what your SLA is. But like, but then if it takes you like 30 minutes or it takes 45 minutes for their people to be like, oh, like that's a thing. And then like, oh, that's not great. And like, I don't really know what to do. And, you know, maybe that 45 minutes is okay for some things, but perhaps like, and again, this is within the context of the team, maybe you can see some struggle to help understand, oh, maybe one person knows I really need help here. I need more people to help me figure out what's going on here and make this an incident and respond. But they're sort of lacking the connections that they need. That's data that you can get. Again, I don't think a single number is going to necessarily tell you that story. You're going to have to ask some questions about that number and sort of observe what's really going on. But you could use that number to sort of analyze, like, do we feel okay about that or not? And start asking those questions.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, the conversation around metrics is so fascinating to me because it's just like a rabbit hole. And yeah, we could talk about this for another 30 minutes. But before we wrap, I'd love to talk about the last myth around documenting risk and that doing that helps you prevent incidents from repeating.
Yeah. So I did my master's degree at Lund University, I'm wearing my hoodie, in human factors and system safety. And my thesis is on the use of quantitative risk assessments in cybersecurity. So this is like a particularly growing practice in the field of cybersecurity to sort of toss a number onto a risk and then present it or advocate, you do something with that, right? I think what I found in reading a lot about this is that people have a tendency to believe that, well, if we write this down, and in some ways, in some cases, we're required to write this down, like there's people have whole GRC teams that do wonderful work trying to sort of track and manage the risk across the organization. It's a big job. But there's this belief that if we write it down and we talk about it and we file it away, that it will be managed. And when we talk about what the controls are for it, as long as we believe that there are controls, we should be good, right? And that's just, that's not like, there's a whole field of sociologists who study risk and something called fantasy documents and how we create these fantasy documents and risk, these kinds of risk analyses are a part of those fantasy documents, which is essentially we think that we can control risk by writing it down. Often instead, what we're doing is by writing it down, we're already kind of starting the process of being like, well, this, we need to accept this. This is how we're going to operate. And like, we'll talk about some controls, but they might not actually happen. There's a great story of a tugboat in the Danish Maritime Accident Investigation Board published a report about this tugboat in the Mediterranean who was like tugging two other large boats at once. And it's the first time they'd ever done this. Usually the tugboat only tugs one. And because it was the first time they'd ever done this, the risk committee got together and they had a conversation and they're like, so it feels like a pretty big risk tugging these two boats behind that if there's like choppy seas or whatever, that like the boats will smash together. And obviously someone was like, yeah, that seems like a risk. We should probably control for it. Okay, well, what are we going to do? I think we should, you know, put some like this inflatable like tubing around. And then that way, when they like kind of crash together, it'll be like, it'll sort of mitigate the like risk there of anything bad happening structurally. And they said, okay, cool. And they like checked it off. And then, you know, the guys are on the boat and sure enough, some storms come and the ships start hitting each other. And they're like, well, you know, we did mitigate that risk. That's why they had those tubes on the side that must be controlled for. And they both sunk because they were watching these ships like essentially take on water and start, but because they thought that the risk had been mitigated, they kind of didn't believe what they were seeing. Like they were like, oh, well, surely that, you know, they knew what they were doing when they had. And it's sort of like, it can be dangerous to write these things down and talk about controls and then even publish them widely, because then, you know, the people on the ground who are kind of watching things unfold can actually disbelieve their own expertise and what they're seeing with their own eyes, right?
Do you have an example of this, like, playing out within the context of incident management, where this, like, idea of, like, risk mitigation isn't actually, like, a thing?
There's a funny law called Lauren's Law. Lauren Hochstein, who's really wonderful in the resilience engineering community, his law is basically that in any sufficiently sort of mitigate, like, I don't know what he called, like, exactly precisely how he words it, but in any sort of software system that's, like, sufficiently complex and has enough going on, any kind of thing that we implement to try to control for, let's say, an incident that happened previously, like, we're going to introduce some automation or some things to check for that or some things to control for that, will likely cause its own incident later, right? That the more that we add these things in, the more that they actually can cause problems. I think anybody has any examples of that happening, where something you put out there because you were like, oh, well, that's a problem, we're going to manage that by introducing this system or this particular automation or something, and suddenly it causes its own particular incident.
So how does this fit into incident management? So, like, obviously you want to be documenting all potential risks, but like you said, you also don't want to just say, okay, documented the risk, we're good. So if something like this happens, we documented the risk, so we're okay. How do you make sure that those two are sort of squared away, that you're both documenting the risk, but not doing so in a way that's just like, okay, we did it, now we can move on?
Risk documentation is often sort of aside from incident management, right? They're related, but they're not totally tied in. I would question, and I think this is what's hard about this, and folks in my program at Lund were all wanting to do their thesis topics on, like, auditing and how all auditing is. And I think this kind of falls into a similar category where you sort of ask, like, if we're documenting risks and then they get filed away and they're not even really controlled for, when we say that they are controlled for, or we can't be sure that they are, then why do we even do it? And I think that's a hard question. It's like an existential question for a whole part of the industry, but it's something that we should ask ourselves. Why are we doing this work? And what kind of value is it providing us? Much like, why are we measuring mean time to recovery? Like, what action are we taking from it? I think there is a similar question here. Are we getting value out of this? Is this really driving real work that needs to happen? Or is it just paperwork that we're filing, right?